The drama of the Reformation is an exciting story of conflict and of courage, of tragedy overcome by Christians in triumph, by bold, dynamic Book of Acts Christianity. One of the greatest times of revival in the church today was the 16th century, the greatest century of Reformation. And what I'm going to try to do now in this next under an hour is to race us through the big picture, the exciting drama, that we can get it chronologically in order, all the different personalities and events and the key issues and doctrines of the Reformation covered in one go. Now, that's quite a bold attempt, and it's very difficult to do. We all know bits and pieces of the Reformation, but to put it in one coherent story, drama, in the chronological way in which it was lived out, in which it came out, I think will be very beneficial for us as we consider what we want God to do in the future. If we want revival, the prayer is, will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? It's the word again. God has worked in revival before, and we need to look and see the acts of obedience and dedication, the kind of bold acts of obedience that God blessed before, to see what we can do in our lives today. And that's where we're really going to be focused this afternoon in particular, is what can we do? Shortly after Martin Luther was born, the last Muslim stronghold of Spain, Granada, fell, and the liberation of the Iberian Peninsula was complete. For 800 years, Spain and Portugal had been under the Muslims, and now they were free. Then Christopher Columbus sailed west across the Atlantic, and he discovered the Americas and the New World. And while southwestern Europe was celebrating its freedom from 8 centuries of oppression and of occupation under Islam, southeastern Europe, the Balkans, were facing relentless onslaughts of invasions by the Muslim Turks. And soon there was the fall of the greatest city in the world at that time, Constantinople, to the Turks in 1453, with the massacre of all the Christians in that city. The Turks became an ever-present danger and threat to Christendom, as Europe was then known. Threatened from the east by a relentless Islamic jihad, Europe was suffering also from the internal corruption of the Renaissance. The Renaissance was a time of material advance, but of spiritual decline. There were some good things to the Renaissance, especially in Northern Europe, but in Southern Europe, it was as corrupt as could be. It led to the rise of absolutism, because as they worshipped Greece and Rome, they saw the absolutism of the Caesars of Rome, and they thought, we've got to get back to that kind of situation. There was a tremendous loss of individual rights and representative governments, which Christian principles had developed throughout the Middle Ages. And so, as we saw absolutism rise in Europe and Islam threatening from the East, Europe started at this stage to go back to ancient Rome. And even though ancient Rome had practiced human sacrifices and slavery and infanticide, and although they persecuted Christians and fed Christians to wild beasts, Renaissance scholars began to extol and hail the pagans as wiser than the Christian, and their times as superior. And this Renaissance trend to turn towards the graves of Rome and of Greece, it was not progress, as they proclaimed. Actually, it was regression. It was a rejection of the Christian faith. And while the Renaissance Italians revived the pagan writings and customs of ancient Greece and Rome and unearthed their statues and their paintings and their plays, immorality flourished and degeneracy accelerated. Along with the physical and intellectual exhumations of these corpses came the ancient intellectual diseases that had led both Rome and Greece to self-destruction and had come to infect life in Europe. Literature became shallow and imitative. Sounds a bit like what we have today. Absurd ancient theories about humours were resuscitated at the expense of real medical research. Everyone's municipal freedoms and individual rights were lost as the humanists extolled the tyrannical Roman laws which tyrants began to adopt. People often think of the Middle Ages as a bad time. In fact, the Middle Ages were in many cases excellent, because during the Middle Ages, Europe was Christianized and evangelized and discipled, and a lot of good things happened. And during the Middle Ages, they built the cathedrals, some of the greatest architectural masterpiece the world has ever seen. And they had the principle of municipal rights. Nobody could be taxed unless they had given the authority to their representatives in their municipality to give them the right to be taxed. They had municipal rights and freedoms better than we have today. The impact of glorifying a licentious past was absolutely devastating upon the morals and the behavior of Southern Europe. And the despairing conclusion of Renaissance humanism was that life is meaningless. And to escape from this intellectual cul-de-sac, this dead-end street, many people began to plunge into blind fortune and magic, astrology. Many people who had lost their belief in sin and are rejecting the idea of eternal life desperately sought for earthly fame and fortune. Paganism deepened as the Renaissance extended. And from the 14th to the 16th century, many cities in southern Europe appointed official astrologers. Universities had official stargazers. Even the popes read their horoscopes. With almost any position in a Roman Catholic Church open to the highest bidder, church positions were dominated by corrupt, money-grabbing humanists who ruthlessly persecuted genuine believers. And this is when the church came under severe persecution. Martin Luther, a brilliant lawyer and a theologian, visited Rome in 1510. And Luther was shocked at the corruption and the degeneracy in Rome. Everything is permitted in Rome, he said, except to be an honest man. To finance the Pope's extravagant living and the construction of St. Peter's Cathedral, the Catholic Church began selling dispensations, which allowed the purchasers to break the church's rules, to eat meat on fast days, to marry a close relative, to commit adultery, and so on. Those were dispensations. And in addition, the Catholic Church sold indulgences, which could be cashed in heaven, to which they claimed to hold the keys. Even today, you see the Catholic Church's flag has got the keys, they say, of St. Peter on the flag. There's two keys crossed. They claim that the Pope has the power to determine who goes to heaven and who does not. They have the keys. And so these heavenly credits could be balanced against your sins committed on earth, they taught. These earthly and spiritual pardons were being sold by a Dominican monk, Johann Tetzel, in Saxony. And that was when Dr. Martin Luther, now a professor at Wittenberg University, wrote his 95 theses, his 95 arguments against these wicked practices in protest. Luther argued that only God could forgive sins, and it was better for people to help the poor than to buy an indulgence. And truly repentant people don't seek to avoid punishment, but they desire to seek it. And this was what led to 95 theses being nailed on the church door in Wittenberg, which is what we are celebrating on this day, the 31st of October. This is Reformation Day. Luther's challenge was in Latin. It was meant for scholarly debate. But some enterprising young printer soon printed it into German, got it translated, began to print and sell copies of it, and soon these theses were available in French, and in Spanish, and Flemish, and Dutch, and Italian. And soon Luther's dramatic challenge against the unbiblical practices of indulgences were being read in the marketplaces, in the palaces of Europe, and even the Pope was given a copy to read. Between 1517 and 1520, in just those 3 years, 300,000 copies of Luther's writings were sold throughout Europe. It was the first time in history that any medium, that any revolutionary idea had impacted an entire continent through a mass medium. He was really the first journalist. Translators, printers, journalists, and itinerant salesmen worked together to challenge the entire social and ecclesiastical system of the Catholic Church and of the Roman Empire. At about that same time that Cortes was entering Mexico, encountering Montezuma and the bloodthirsty Aztec Empire, Luther was challenging the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. He taught that faith alone, not good works, make man righteous. Good works follow from faith. A tree bears good fruit, but the fruit does not bear the tree. Luther taught that we could not only receive forgiveness from our sins, but victory over the power of sin. Not just saved from the penalty of sin, but from the power of sin. Catholicism teaches salvation in sin. You continue to sin, but you just go to confession and mass and get your slate wiped clean till next week. There's not a salvation from sin, it's a salvation in sin. Unfortunately, we've got a lot of churches teaching that too now on the so-called Protestant side, but they're not real Protestants, are they? And so, victory over the power of our own carnal nature by God's grace alone. By the end of 1520, Luther was proclaiming the Pope as Antichrist. He was excommunicated by the Pope, and all that stood between Luther and death at the hands of the Emperor was the protection of the Elector of Saxony, Prince Frederick, who said, "There's much in the Bible about Christ, but not much about Rome." Prince Frederick of Saxony was one of the most senior and influential electors in Germany. He had been a serious contender for the position of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charles V was the Emperor of Germany, King of Spain, King of Sardinia, King of Sicily and the Netherlands. His ships were sailing around the globe. His vast armies dominated all of Europe. However, Charles V could not ignore the authority of the Elector of Saxony. Prince Frederick was important because Germany was still largely feudal and the Emperor's power was not absolute. They had strong decentralization as well. And the German people still enjoyed many of the rights and powers which the Renaissance had swept away elsewhere. Only recently crowned Emperor, just 21 years old, Charles V had to be seen to respect the authority of the electors who had just put him on the throne. And Prince Frederick extracted a guarantee of safe conduct for Luther from the Emperor, which was crucial. Summoned to Worms on the 18th of May, 1521, Martin Luther stood firm before the Emperor and six princes or electors, 24 dukes, 30 archbishops and bishops, seven ambassadors, all gathered together for one purpose, to intimidate Luther to back down, to recant. The young Emperor sat on a raised dais, surrounded by men in gleaming armor, mitred archbishops, splendidly dressed nobles. Should have intimidated him into backing down, but it didn't. Luther was denied any opportunity to debate or defend his doctrines. He was asked two questions. First, to confirm that the publications on the table were his, which he did. And secondly, whether he would recant, admit his writings were heretical, and to reject them. Luther confirmed that the books, booklets, and leaflets were his writings, but he pointed out there were of different types. Some included accepted Christian doctrines. He couldn't recant scriptural truth. Others of his works exposed popery and the corrupt living and scandalous abuses and evils of the popes. If he were to reject these writings, then he would be like a cloak that covers evil. At this, the emperor leaned forward and shouted, "No." But Luther continued that others of his works were against private individuals who had attacked his work and attempted to defend popery, and he confessed that in these he had written too harshly. The court demanded that Luther recant all his writings. Pressed again in Latin if he would recant, Luther answered in German, so that all the people around could hear what he was saying. "Unless I am convinced by scripture or clear reasoning that I am wrong. For popes and councils have often erred and contradicted themselves. I cannot recant, for I am subject to the scriptures I have quoted. My conscience is captive to the word of God. It is unsafe and dangerous to do anything against one's conscience. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. So help me God. Amen." Luther's courageous and historic speech shook the world. It shook the authority of the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church. Furious, Charles V wanted Luther burned as a heretic right there and then. But Prince Frederick insisted that he honor his guarantee of safe conduct. Luther was allowed to leave. But the emperor and four of the princes, the electors, signed a statement declaring Luther an outlaw. Prince Frederick of Saxony and the elector of the Palatine refused to sign. While frantic efforts were made to arrest Luther, Prince Frederick secretly arranged for his kidnapping and spiriting away to be hidden as Junker York or Knight George in the Wartburg Castle. There in disguise and seclusion, Luther began a Bible translation blitzkrieg, and by the next year, 1522, the German New Testament was on sale for but a week's wages. Up till then, if you wanted a Bible, it would cost about a year's wages for a Bible. It would take 6 months of a monk to write out the whole Bible. So you can imagine why it would take a year's wages for the cost of the printing, the binding. I mean, it was a very expensive thing to have a Bible before, the handwritten Bibles. Now, with the printing press, you could have the Bible for about a week's wages. Back in Wittenberg, Luther's colleague Philip Melanchthon, 21-year-old professor of Greek, and Andreas Bodenstein-Karlstadt, a 30-year-old professor of philosophy and theology, they continued the work of Reformation in Luther's absence. Karlstadt took Luther's intellectual rebellion and he turned it into a religious revolution. He whipped up the crowds to destroy statues and shrines and all religious artifacts as idols that needed to be destroyed. When Luther heard about this, he was shocked. The church was being desecrated, mobs coming in and breaking things. This wasn't what he had in mind. They'd taken the law into their own hands, and they should not do that. Everything should be done decently and in order. And eliminating idolatry in our hearts comes before eradicating images in the churches. Yes, some people like the idea of smashing statues, but what about the idols in their own hearts? They're missing the point. Now, images were a central means of communicating gospel truths in the Middle Ages. As very few of the population could read and write, Bible stories were often depicted through stained glass windows and statues and pictures. And you can go into the cathedrals today and be impressed and amazed, and a lot of it does have very good Bible truths in these windows. Although there's a lot of superstitious stuff in the Catholic cathedrals too. And it began to be accepted in the Middle Ages that Christians should not only learn the faith through these visual representations, but should express their faith by reverencing these images. And so this became a serious problem, of course. An entire devotional system was developed and an industry involving carpenters and printers and goldsmiths and silversmiths and other artisans built their livelihoods around providing images for the church. So the Reformation, with its rejection of such idolatry, posed an economic threat to these people. And you can imagine how they responded. There are some beautiful images in these cathedrals, but there's a lot that are hindrances to worship, not aids at all. Luther was far and away the most popular author in Europe. His writings outsold all others in Spain and France and Italy and the Netherlands and Switzerland and England and in Germany. And here you can see some of the woodcuts in Luther's writings where he exposes things not only in words but also in pictures. Luther was far and away the most popular author in Europe. His writings outsold all others in Spain and in France and Italy and the Netherlands, all over. More than half of the printed works in Europe were Luther's writings at that time. Priests and nuns poured out of the church and rushed towards marriage, and princes were converted to the Reformation. And the new Pope, Adrian VI, elected in 1521. Interesting, Leo X didn't survive very long. He died very quickly after Luther's bold stand. And he demanded Luther's arrest. The Prince of Saxony refused to cooperate. It's quite extraordinary that he stood by Luther against the whole Holy Roman Empire. Radical opportunists like Thomas Munzer used this intellectual and spiritual upheaval to try and launch a political revolution. And by the end of 1524, 30,000 armed peasants had risen up and began to loot castles and monasteries and pillage churches and kidnap nobles and demanding ransoms, and they committed widespread arson and mass murder. Luther was horrified, and in 1524 he wrote against the robbing and murdering horde of peasants. And he not only dissociated from these bandits and revolutionaries, but he applied biblical principles as to the duty of the princes to use the sword to protect the law-abiding and to punish the lawbreakers. And the princes responded decisively against this anarchy and against this lawlessness. Munzer and his 5,000 of his followers were wiped out by the knights. Another 20,000 rebellious peasants were killed in Alaska. But the greatest loss of life during the Peasants' Rebellion occurred in Austria under the Roman Catholic Emperor. Charles V's younger brother Ferdinand crushed the rebellion with 130,000 dead in battle or by execution. The peasants' revolt was disastrous. Hundreds of castles and monasteries had been ruined. Hundreds of towns depopulated and impoverished. 50,000 homeless wandered the countryside or hid in the forests. There were many widows and many orphans. And because many of the rebels had destroyed the charters that recorded the municipal rights of the people and the feudal dues, new charters were drawn up, now far more demanding, with far less provision of checks and balances to protect the rights of the common people. And censorship laws started to be enforced all over Europe. The end result was very negative politically. Then in 1526, the Muslim Turks attacked Hungary. And Suleiman the Magnificent, he gave himself that name, overwhelmed the small Hungarian army of 30,000 with his army of 300,000. 10 Muslims to 1. And King Louis X of Hungary was killed, and the capital of Hungary, Buda, what today is Budapest, was put to the sword, looted, and the Muslims carried off over 200,000 Christians into Islamic slavery. This is 1526, the year before Luther wrote, "A mighty fortress is our God." This is the political, geostrategic context of a lot of the Reformation actions. Then in 1526, you can see after the destruction, here's Budapest being put to investment, besieged. The next year, 1527, Emperor Charles V led his army to capture Rome, the richest city in Europe. The corruption and the meddling of the Pope of Rome had outraged even this ardent Catholic Charles V. Now his army sacked Rome itself, and the Pope was held for an immense ransom. Throughout Europe, this was seen as the judgment of God upon a corrupt city, a debauched city, and a very corrupt church. The Catholic Inquisition in the Netherlands demanded that all hold to and believe the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church. Men and women who disobey this command shall be punished as disturbers of the public order. Women who fall into heresy shall be burned alive. Men, if they recant, shall lose their heads. If they continue obstinate, they shall be burned at the stake. The Inquisition is to inquire into the private opinions of every person, of whatever degree. Law officers of all kinds shall assist the Inquisition at their peril. Those who know where heretics are concealed shall denounce them, or they shall suffer as heretics themselves. This is the edict that was passed in the Netherlands. And under this edict alone, in the Netherlands alone, 50,000 Protestants were executed. In Switzerland, Ulrich Zwingli had launched a parallel reformation, starting with the expositionary preaching of Matthew, starting in chapter 1, verse 1, on the 1st of January, 1519, in Grossmünster, the great cathedral in Zurich. And the city council supported Zwingli's reforms, and all Zurich clergymen were ordered to preach only from the scriptures. The Bible became the basis for all law. The religious images and statues and relics and ornaments were removed from the churches. Monks, nuns, and priests were permitted to marry, and soon other Swiss cantons were embracing the Reformation. In 1529, a Protestant missionary from Zurich was burned at the stake for preaching the gospel in the Catholic canton of Schweiz. Zurich stopped all trade with Schweiz in protest, and the Catholic cantons declared war. At the Battle of Kappel, October 1531, 8,000 Catholic soldiers opposed the 1,500 Protestant soldiers of Zurich, and Swiss reformer Ulrich Zwingli was wounded in this battle, and he was killed by a Catholic captain when he refused to call upon the Virgin Mary. At the beginning of the 16th century, France was the largest and the richest nation in Europe. France had a population of 16 million people at that time. Spain had 7 million, England only had 3 million. Paris was the largest city in Europe with a population of 300,000. Luther's books poured into France. The French reformer, Jacques Lefebvre, published a French translation of the New Testament in 1523 and the next year of the Psalms. And he was denounced for doing this as a heretic. Francis I, King of France, ordered vigorous persecution to stamp out the Protestant faith in his realm. Protestants were branded, their hands and their noses amputated, red-hot irons were applied to the head. Many were burned alive. At the same time as Francis I, the king, was ordering mutilations and persecutions and tortures on Protestants, his sister, Marguerite, was herself praying with the reformer William Farel and protecting the Protestants in her own castle. Brilliant young law student John Calvin was converted to the Protestant faith and started to call for a purified church. He stressed salvation through grace. He wrote a treatise on life after death, another on Christian doctrine. Calvin was arrested twice, and after a number of life-threatening escapes, Calvin was declared an outlaw, and he was on the run from the authority, changing names, having disguises, escaping out of windows with bedsheets tied together while a soldier breaking in to try and arrest him. He was a man on the run. By 1536, Calvin had produced the Institutes of the Christian Religion, a theological masterpiece, systematically expounding the biblical faith, conduct, and devotion of a Protestant. When the dynamic French Protestant preacher Guillemin Farel first came to Geneva, it was a very immoral city. Geneva had a prostitute's quarter. A priest living with concubines was not unheard of. Corrupt bishop. Farrell first came to Geneva in October 1532. Farrell was a missionary from Bern, the strongest Protestant canton in Switzerland. Farrell had played a leading role in bringing about the triumph of the Reformation in Bern and in Neuchâtel and several other towns, and he had won over the Waldensians to embrace the principles of the Reformation. Farrell's fiery preaching and unbeatable logic in debate with the Catholics won the city. As hundreds of Genevans were won to Christ, Farrell seized the Cathedral of Saint-Pierre on the 21st of April, 1536, and the General Assembly of Citizens voted in favor of the Reformation and made the Protestant faith the official religion of Geneva. With Geneva in revolt against its bishop and against the Duke of Savoy, Farrell knew that his eloquence and his evangelistic zeal was not sufficient to disciple this distracted city. It was at this opportune time that a local war caused Calvin to divert through Geneva. He had only planned to spend one night in Geneva. But when Farrell heard that this famous French scholar and author was passing through, he hurried over to recruit him. Calvin's mind was set on his studies, but Farrell would have none of it. He threatened that God would curse his studies if he refused to aid the church in Geneva at this time. Visibly shaken, struck with terror, Calvin reluctantly agreed to serve in Geneva. And Calvin began his ministry in the Church of St. Peter by preaching through the epistles of St. Paul. King Francis I of France then shocked all of Christendom by making an alliance with the Muslim Turks in his war against Charles V. His political and military gamble failed, he was defeated, he died bankrupt and disgraced in 1546. Now the deaths of both Francis I and of Henry VIII in the same year, 1547, emphasized the turbulence of that time when Luther, Zwingli, Farrell and Tyndale contended with the popes and with Charles V and with Henry VIII and Francis I for the mind and the heart and the soul of Europe and all of Christendom. The Protestant faith swept across Europe, flourishing in Switzerland, Germany, Holland, England and Scotland. Scottish reformer George Weishaupt was burned at the stake in Scotland, and the archbishop responsible for his execution, Cardinal David Beaton, was brutally assassinated in revenge. The Protestants captured the castle of St. Andrews, and they were joined by John Knox. They were besieged by a French fleet, and they were captured and condemned to the galleys. And John Knox ended up as a galley slave. When King Henry VIII of England died, his nine-year-old son, a dedicated Protestant, Edward VI, became king. This was the time for Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, who initiated sweeping reforms. All paintings and images were removed from churches of England. The Mass was abolished and replaced with communion. The English language replaced Latin in worship services. The English Book of Common Prayer was introduced. Priests received permission to marry. Stone altars were demolished, replaced with communion tables. Protestant books and pamphlets flooded into England. A dramatic transformation. Guided by John Calvin's biblical teaching and systematic preaching, Geneva became the hub of the Reformation. As Wittenberg had been the hub of the Reformation in the days of Luther, now the second generation reformer John Calvin makes Geneva the hub of the Reformation. Refugees fleeing persecution found sanctuary in Geneva. Calvin's writings produced the greatest concentration of printers and publishing firms in the world. Calvin established an academy that taught Greek, Hebrew, Latin, and theology. Graduates of Calvin's academy carried the Reformation teachings into France and Holland and Germany and in Scotland, England. And this is the academy of John Calvin and his auditoire. King Edward VI of England then intervened to secure the release of the Protestants of St. Andrews, including John Knox, from the galleys of France in a prison exchange. Knox was appointed a royal chaplain to the king, and he helped Archbishop Cranmer producing the Book of Common Prayer. Then the young Protestant king, Edward VI, became seriously ill. He suffered from measles, from chickenpox, smallpox, and tuberculosis. Rumors that King Edward had been poisoned by a Catholic assassin abounded. He died in such a way that if they could have done an autopsy, they probably would have proved poison. But he had all the symptoms that later doctors looking back said the man was definitely poisoned. Fears for the future of the Reformation in England and the imminent death of King Edward VI at just age 16 caused the regent, the Duke of Northumberland, to persuade the king to alter the laws of succession to bypass his Catholic sister Mary and crown Lady Jane Grey as queen, who was the finest Protestant in line for the throne that they had. In the end, Edward's death came swiftly, as the Catholic forces mustered to place Mary Tudor on the throne of England. Jane was queen for only 9 days, when the forces of Mary arrested and imprisoned her in the Tower of London. Pressured by her cousin Mary to renounce the Protestant faith and to embrace Catholicism, the 16-year-old Lady Jane courageously remained steadfast. She was beheaded as a result. There are several pages given to her courageous testimony in Fox's Book of Martyrs. Bloody Mary married the heir to the Holy Roman Empire, Prince Philip of Spain. Philip arrived with a huge fleet of ships and a vast Spanish entourage to dominate the English court. Cardinal Reginald Pole was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, and England was formally returned to Catholicism. The most prominent Protestant bishops, including Hooper and Ridley and Latimer, the previous Archbishop Cranmer, they were burned at the stake, followed by hundreds of other prominent Protestant leaders, and with every execution, resistance to Catholicism spread and commitment to the Reformation doctrines deepened, and the people of England determined never to go back to Catholicism. As Charles V abdicated in 1556, Mary's husband Philip became King Philip II, and soon English troops and cavalry were being sent to the Netherlands to help crush the widespread Protestant revolt there. From the perspective of the Holy Roman Empire, the year 1558 was disastrous. Charles V, the emperor, who Martin Luther had defied with his "My conscience is captive to the word of God, here I stand" speech, Charles V died in agony. 21st of September, 1558. Charles V, by his own estimation, had condemned 30,000 Protestants to torturous executions during his reign. Shortly after that, on the 17th of November, 1558, Bloody Mary died of fever. 12 hours later, her Cardinal Pole, Archbishop Canterbury, died of the same fever in Lambeth Palace. So 1559 began with the Protestants on the march, with the Catholic cause in defeat and retreat. Emperor Charles V was now dead. His sister Mary, the former regent of the Netherlands, had also died. Mary of Lorraine, regent of Scotland, was out of power and on the run. Bloody Mary's counter-reformation had been counterproductive. Instead of returning England to Catholicism, she had only succeeded in entrenching the vast majority of Englishmen in a commitment to the Reformation. On the 15th of January, 1559, Protestant Elizabeth Tudor was crowned Queen of England. On the 2nd of May, 1559, John Knox returned from exile to Scotland, and his fiery sermon against idolatry galvanized the Scottish into immediate action. You can actually see here in the picture in the stained glass windows, people in church with their helmets and their armor and with their battle axes and their swords and their pikes. What a sermon that must have been. They went straight from there and smashed idols and images, and it was an incredible move. Altars were demolished. Images, statues and crucifixes were removed from churches. The Scottish lords of the congregation worked together with the English to force all French troops to leave Scottish soil. The Scottish Parliament instructed Knox to draw up a confession of faith, which was adopted into law. In 1560, the Geneva Bible was published. Before it was replaced by the King James Bible in 1611, over 140 editions of the Geneva Bible were published. Many people speak of the King James being the language of Shakespeare and of the early pilgrims in America. Not so. It was the Geneva Bible, which was the language of Shakespeare. And it was Geneva Bible quoted throughout the works of Shakespeare and by the early pilgrims. The attempt to return Scotland to Catholicism by the return of Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, in 1561, put the Reformation in serious jeopardy. Mary Stuart was heir to England's throne if Elizabeth died without children. Numerous Catholic assassination attempts and intrigues to replace Elizabeth with Mary, Queen of Scots, underlined the peril to the cause of the Reformation and freedom in England alone. Mary, Queen of Scots' immorality and her intrigues outraged the population of Scotland. John Knox's courageous confrontations of Mary and the scandal caused by her complicity in the murder of her husband and the marrying of his murderer finally led to her being forced to abdicate in 1567, and her infant son was crowned. He was James VI of Scotland, and he later became James I of England, famous for the man under whom the King James version of the Bible was translated. Knox preached at James VI's coronation. Of course, he's James VI of Scotland, but James I of the United Kingdom of Scotland and England. Meanwhile, while the Reformation was triumphing in Britain, it was under relentless attack on the continent of Europe. Charles V's son, Philip II, was determined to crush the flourishing Protestant faith in Holland, and so in 1566, Philip issued a proclamation requiring all his subjects to accept the decrees made by the Council of Trent. All who would not comply with these demands were to be delivered to the inquisitors. In 1567, Philip sent in the Spanish troops, led by the cruel Duke of Alva. Alva set up the Council of Blood, which had 8,000 Protestants executed in Holland. Another 30,000 Dutch people had their property confiscated. In 1568, the Inquisition condemned all the inhabitants of the Netherlands. That's all 3 million people, men, women, and children, condemned them to death as heretics. William the Silent, Prince of Orange, became the leader of the persecuted Dutch Protestants. William and his Dutch soldiers fought valiantly despite overwhelming odds. Remember, Holland was a colony of Spain at that time. Their greatest strength was a skilled navy, which, although they were vastly outnumbered and outgunned by the Spanish, yet the Dutch triumphed over the Spanish time and again at sea. In 1579, the seven northern provinces joined to form the United Provinces of the Netherlands. And in 1581, the United Provinces declared the Netherlands to be independent of Spain. In 1584, the Dutch suffered a severe blow when a Spanish agent assassinated Prince William, the father of Dutch liberties. The Dutch Protestants, though, continued to fight for their freedom until 1648, when, at last, they secured their independence from Spain. That's very interesting for us here in Cape Town, because only 4 years later that Holland was able to send out the governor, Jan van Riebeeck, to establish the Cape settlement out of which Cape Town has developed. If Holland had not been freed from the oppression of Catholic Spain, it would not have been able to establish a Protestant faith here. It was not as though Europe's only threat was from the treacherous tyrants within. Just the year before the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France, Europe faced a most desperate threat, an attack from the Muslim Turks. In 1571, the Muslim Turks, the Turkish Empire, stretched from the Ukraine to Hungary, to Egypt, to Persia, from North Africa, and to the Caspian Sea. Turkish warships were attacking Christian shipping all across North Africa. Turkish pirates were looting and pillaging the coast of Europe, capturing Christians as slaves from as far afield as England and Ireland. In 1571, Cyprus fell to the Turks. 5,000 Greek and Italian Christians were killed. 30,000, they actually were fighting against 30,000 Turkish attackers in their fierce resistance, and those 5,000 beat off 30,000 until all their supplies were exhausted and they had guarantees of safe conduct if they surrendered. They finally surrendered when they had run out of all food and supplies. And that was in Cyprus. But the Turks, treacherously, had all the Venetian prisoners executed, and the rest of the Christians were shipped to Constantinople as slaves. And the courageous Christian general, Bragadino, had his nose and his ears cut off, his teeth broken, and he was whipped daily until the 17th of August, when he was flayed alive in the city square. This is how the Turks honored their guarantee of safe conduct. The Turks laid waste to the island of Corfu and amassed their fleets to attack Europe. The European forces were led by Don John of Austria, half-brother of Philip II. The Battle of Lepanto on the 7th of October 1571 was one of the most crucial naval battles in all of history. The Christian forces, with 208 warships, were outnumbered by the much larger Turkish fleet of 230. The Christian forces closed in for the fight in hand-to-hand combat with the enemy. Spanish infantry flowed onto the Turkish vessels, and in ferocious hand-to-hand combat, they overwhelmed the Turks. The Turkish losses were estimated to be overwhelming. Over 30,000 Turks were killed in this battle, and 15,000 were taken prisoner. But on their side, the Christians lost only 10 galleys, 8,000 killed, 21,000 wounded. Lepanto was one of the greatest turning points in history. It ended the fear of the Turks that had threatened to overwhelm all of Europe. It stopped the Turkish advance. Church bells tolled throughout the whole of Europe. Many prayers of thanksgiving were offered by millions of grateful Europeans. As historian Otto Scott put it, only God could have saved so divided a Europe against so determined and savage, so rich and heavily armed a foe. After Lepanto, the Turks remained a menace, but not an unconquerable one. And here you can see a picture of the map of Europe at that time. Notice how the Ottoman Empire stretched all the way up to Budapest, very close to Vienna, which was threatened with sieges as late as 1683. The very heart of Europe was threatened by the Muslims. And so we cannot underestimate the importance of the Reformation in energizing a Europe that was so weak and decaying that it was about to fall to the Muslims. Only a new Reformation today could save Europe from a similar fate of being overwhelmed by Islam today. The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre horrified Protestants worldwide, and it entrenched the conviction that the Catholic Church was treacherous, that any guarantees given by them or treaties signed by them would not be honoured. Up to 30,000 Protestant Christians were massacred throughout the whole of France, including about 8,000 in Paris alone, including the massacre of Admiral Gaspard de Coligny, the admiral who is the head of the French Huguenots. The massacre was ordered by King Charles IX under the influence of his wicked Jezebel mother, Catherine de Medici. The St. Bartholomew Day Massacre on the 24th of August 1572 began at 3 in the morning. The first to be murdered was this aristocratic Admiral Coligny. Henry of Guy supervised the attack. His men burst into Coligny's home, stabbed the admiral and threw him out the window. As Coligny landed at Guy's feet, Henry of Guy spat on the body and then told his men to spread the word that the king commanded death to all the Huguenots. Kill them all, kill them all, he said. There was horrible slaughter and mutilations which followed. Approximately 5,000 Protestants murdered just in Paris, in the precincts alone. The Spanish ambassador wrote, "As I write, they're killing them all, they're stripping them naked, sparing not even the children. Blessed be God." This was meant to be a positive report to the Pope. And the Pope ordered special celebrations in Rome and even coins to be struck depicting the Catholic saying with crucifix over while blood flows from Protestants being murdered at their feet. And that coin was minted. Similar massacres occurred in Lyon, Dijon, Tours, Royan, Troyes, Toulouse. A total of 30,000 Protestants murdered on one day throughout all of France. That was the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which let the people of Europe know that there could be no going back, there could be no compromise with Catholicism. When the news reached Rome, the Cardinal of Lorraine gave the bearer of this news 1,000 crowns as reward. Gregory XIII and his cardinals attended a solemn high mass of thanksgiving, and the Pope ordered the special medal depicting here, commemorating the massacre with the word, "The Pope approves the killing of Coligny." The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre permanently altered Protestant thinking. Calvinists turned from previously accepting the divine right of kings to questioning the entire institution of the monarchy. The Catholic cause, already stained with the atrocities of Bloody Mary, the persecutions in England, the Duke of Alva's slaughter in the Netherlands, the Catholic cause was now indelibly identified with the most bestial persecutions, tyranny and treachery, as depicted in Fox's Book of Martyrs. 2 months later, the Calvinists launched an offensive that lasted nearly a year. At its conclusion, King Charles IX was forced to sign another treaty guaranteeing freedom of worship in France. English gold and practical support boosted the Protestant resistance in the Netherlands and also in Scotland. And Jesuit assassins and conspirators arrived in England to arrange for the overthrow of Elizabeth I. It's impossible to count how many assassination attempts she survived. Some estimates are 28, others are over 60. There were so many intrigues to try and kill Elizabeth I as the Protestant Queen of England. An army bearing papal banners invaded Ireland. 1583, a Catholic plot involving English noblemen and a Spanish plan for invasion was uncovered. The Spanish ambassador was understandably expelled from England. As long as Mary Stuart remained alive, she represented a clear and present danger to the life of Elizabeth. and the survival of the Protestant faith and freedom in England was similarly threatened. Mary Stuart represented Spain, the vast Catholic international, and the guises of France. Parliament placed Mary Stuart on trial at Fotheringay Castle, and despite attempts by Elizabeth to stop the proceedings, Mary Stuart was sentenced to death, and she was executed on the 12th of May, 1587, against the wishes of her cousin, of course. Philip II, who had recently conquered Portugal, now began to prepare for invasion of England. And this is while France was torn by a civil war with three armies in the field, one led by the giggling transvestite with a whitened face, Henry III, the other by Henry, Duke of Guise, and the third by Henry of Navarre, who was a Protestant. King Philip of Spain then launched what the Spaniards called the Invincible Armada. The world had never before seen such a powerful feat. Having recently defeated the Turkish fleet, the tiny English navy was not perceived to be any significant obstacle to the Spanish invasion and conquest of England. Philip looked forward to the destruction of the Protestants and the restoration of Catholicism in England. And with the English support severed, it would be easy, he thought, to finally crush the rebellion in the Netherlands. However, while churches throughout England held extraordinary prayer meetings, a storm wrecked the Spanish plans. The Duke of Parma's invasion barges from Holland were not able to be used. The English tactics of sending fireships amongst the huge Spanish galleons sowed confusion. Courageous action by English seamen and continuing storms decimated and broke up the Spanish armada. Dutch support also helped the English defeat the Spanish armada, and most of what was left of Philip's fleet was devastated by more storms on the coast of Ireland and Scotland. Only a miserable remnant of the once proud armada limped back into the ports of Spain. 51 Spanish ships and 20,000 men had been lost. The English navy had not even lost one ship. The greatest superpower of Europe at that time, had suffered a crippling blow at the hand of England. The defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 marked one of the great watersheds of history. It signaled the decline of Spain and the rise of England. Commemorative medals were struck with inscriptions, "God blew," and they were scattered. "And man proposes, God disposes." Before 1588, the world powers were Spain and Portugal. They divided the world amongst themselves. These Roman Catholic empires dominate the seas and overseas possessions of Europe. Only after the English defeated the Spanish Armada did the possibility arise of Protestant missions crossing the seas. It might be recalled that amongst the many missionary enterprises launched by John Calvin, one was a mission team that went to Brazil. Do you know they didn't survive the year? Every member of that mission team that went to Brazil was exposed and killed before the year was out. Just showing how impossible it was to work in Catholic countries across the seas while Spain and Portugal remained the superpowers of the world. And often we forget some of the geopolitical backgrounds to what was going on at that time. And so now, foreign missions became a distinct possibility, including to the Cape. Had the Armada succeeded, recent history would be unrecognizable. In the 16th century, Spain led the Catholic cause. England led the Protestant cause. All of Europe feared Spain. Spain had defeated every adversary, including the feared Turk. The Catholic nations of Europe had every expectation that Spain would succeed in crushing the Protestants by conquering England and Holland. And when the Armada failed, the mystique of Spanish invincibility was destroyed. With the defeat of Catholic Spain, the Vatican cause floundered. If Bloody Mary had undermined the Catholic credibility, the defeat of the Spanish Armada eradicated every hope that the Reformation in England could be reversed. The extraordinary energies that had been released by the rediscovery of the Bible in the common tongue had led to the most extraordinary spiritual revival in history. It had freed the Christians of Northern Europe from the decadence of Renaissance paganism and led to the greatest birth of freedom and scientific discovery in history. That is why we say the 16th century was the greatest century of Reformation. May God do it again. May we see a fresh move with the faith of Martin Luther, with the back to the Bible preaching of Professor John Wycliffe. Here I stand, I can do no other. So help me God. These are covered in the book, The Greatest Century of Reformation, and in the manuals we've got. You'll find many of these articles on Reformation on the reformationsa.org website. I encourage you to access that. You'll see it on a lot of the literature today. We have many CDs covering some of these dramatic stories of key individuals and events in the Reformation. Some of the best are put into the Great Reformation box set. Tomorrow is Reformation Sunday, the closest Sunday to Reformation Day. And those who can are welcome and encouraged to join us for the 11 o'clock Reformation Sunday celebration at the Huguenot Monument. We are blessed in Cape Town to have a Protestant monument and museum so close to our city with an hour's drive. And if you haven't been there recently, it's a very exhilarating and inspiring spot to go to. We need a revival of prayer. We need to get back to the basics of what reformers taught. This is the 500th year of John Calvin. We had big celebrations on John Calvin's 500th birthday in Geneva earlier on this year in July. And we have many good materials available on that. Those who are thinking on some practical things, and we're going to be this afternoon dealing with the practical sides, but let me say one thing that we think is absolutely vital is challenging a person's entire world and life view. This is not just about our salvation. This affects every aspect of life. There is not one square millimeter of this planet that should not be under the lordship of Jesus Christ. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. And so we need a world and life view transformed. Yet most Christians send their children to the pagans, to the Philistines of today, to be educated. Christian schools, homeschooling, parental involvement in education of children is vital. One thing that we've organized is a crash course for young people to prepare them to face the challenge of the world and to build new reformers for the next generation is to invest in youth. The Biblical Worldview Summit, the first week of January next year, we will be having an opportunity to do just that. And if you want your children's minds and muscles stretched, we will do that. And those who are serious about missions, we've got a great commission course that covers that and continues for another 2 weeks thereafter. It's a three-week intensive, practical, minds and muscles, body, mind and spirit, missions experience, daily outreaches, daily PT, lots of activities and hikes. But to get us back to the subject of the drama of the Reformation, the work of Reformation is not over. The reformers began the work and they've passed the torch to us. It is up to us to work further. Revival is something only God can send. Reformation is what we can do. Reformation is when we get serious with God, we get back to the Bible. When we do what we can, that's Reformation. Then that's when God may move and do what only He can do, what we cannot do. When we do what we can do, God can move and do what we cannot do. We can reform our lives in a sense of getting serious with God, getting back to the Bible, bringing our lives into submission to the Word of God, our families, our churches, our communities. Working for Reformation is our work. Revival is God's work. That is why we speak of work for Reformation, pray for revival.